My name's Larry B., and I'm an alcoholic.
Larry.
Gonna read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I was told to keep it short, so I'm just going to introduce Larry K.
I'm Larry Kowalski, and I'm an alcoholic. My sponsor does want me to give my sobriety date because I'm sobered up close enough to Texas, where we had the Texas tradition where they say if you don't give one, you may not have one. Because of an experience of a power greater than myself that I've come to call God, that I today identify as the greatest friend I have in the universe, that I discovered only through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't found it necessary or desirable to take a drink or a mood-changing chemical today or any today since May the 21st, 1972. And I'm very, very grateful for that. I'm exceptionally nervous, okay, for a variety of reasons. First, Jim is one of my closest friends, and this is our third try at friendship. The first two were based upon sickness. I was in the program new and emotionally screwed up when I met Jim, and Jim was qualifying for the program, and that became a very unhealthy friendship. I think we were both badly hurt when it broke. Years later, Jim contacted me, new in sobriety, to reestablish the friendship, and I remembered how hurt I was and reestablished the friendship on conditions and terms. This was before I really realized that the traditions are the best guide in the world to every relationship. And for a true friendship, there can only be one requirement. And if I set conditions, it's not a friendship. It's an unequal relationship. And when something like that exists, the second person accepts it and somehow resents it, and it comes through. And that one didn't go well. And Jim was sober about, I think, 5 years when he contacted me once more in Oklahoma City. And I remembered the hurt. He was coming to Oklahoma and let's meet again. And I hope it was about 5 years sober, because it has been 15 years of wonderful, wonderful friendship. So I'm talking at a great moment in the life of a very close friend of mine. Jim has told me that he's told people, new people, things about me, and that's another reason I'm very, very nervous. Because I don't live up to my press notices, okay? And as I've told Jim, and there's a truth to this, and the only way to say it is grossly, listening to that son of a bitch is what got me to AA in the first place. I don't like me. So how can I feel I have anything to give you? This is my instincts before the program. And so when I think of talking to a group, I can't picture that I'm going to say anything that can help anybody, because instinctively, when I start off, I still don't like being me. And so that's the second reason why I'm nervous. And the third reason, I'm starting off with what we were like, what has happened, and what we are like now. And you see, I hear a lot of speakers who talk about what we've been like at the greatest moment lately. Well, that's not what I'm supposed to tell you. I'm really supposed to tell you what we are like now. And there's a third reason, and in some ways, it may be the most important as to why I'm nervous. For about the last 10 to 12 years, I've had serious worries about, I'm 61 years old, about seeing signs of Alzheimer's coming in. The last 3 or 4 years, these signs have aggravated quite a bit. My two doctors, I have one in Lawton where I used to be and one in Enid where I met Jim and where I am now. They both agree that I have serious reasons to suspect, if not to think, that I'm either in early Alzheimer's, but the doctor I'm talking to now thinks it's more likely I'm having the series of small strokes. And I'm doing all the things that a person can do to try to tie it down. But my memory is just gone in big, big ways. And I will start talking and forget what I'm talking about and have to come back into the subject. So I'm worried as to whether I can give a good talk, and the memories of my drinking days are going. And so I'm worried about how well I can qualify for you. Now, that's the introduction to the talk, okay? I read on the plane a fable from India about a mouse that's afraid of a cat and goes to a magician, and the magician says, I can help you, and turns the mouse into a cat. And the cat then sees a large dog and is afraid of the large dog and goes to the magician, and the magician says, I can help you, and turns the cat into a large dog. And the dog then sees a large tiger and is afraid of the tiger and goes to the magician. And the magician says, I can help you, and turns the dog into a large tiger. And the tiger then sees a hunter and is afraid and goes to the magician. And the magician says, I can't help you. I gave you the body of a tiger, but you still had the heart of a mouse. And that's how I came into life, with the heart of a mouse, in what looked like a world of cats and dogs, taggers and hunters. And that's really the best description. And I looked for a magician to change me, and I found magicians. I felt ugly first. In first grade, my ears stuck out straight like this, and they were quite large. And to show you how profound the effect of this was on my life, I absolutely never knew when I grew into my ears. I carry a picture, I could not have looked at this picture 15 years sober, it would have destroyed me, of me in first grade, and I could see how big the ears are. And after I came to peace with this through the program, I would circulate this picture at AA meetings, and the first time I did it, two different people, stunned, said, when did you have plastic surgery? I was called Dumbo by kids in school, and they meant it. I was called Dumbo to hurt me by a brother, and Dumbo when my mother just flew off a hanger, off the handle in anger to hurt me. And so I blocked out my face. And hearing a lot of fifth steps, I run a quick test on people to see if they are at peace with their own looks. And I ask people to close their eyes and picture their face. And the reason I did this, because I was 12 years sober. I was 47 years old before I was capable of picturing my face in my own imagination for the first time. And it was at an AA conference. And we had closed, we were in Jonesboro, Arkansas, and in great love, somebody, we all joined hands, and somebody sang in a very spiritual way, not a showy way, the Lord's Prayer. It's, you know, it's one of the few times I've heard it sung, the only time at a conference. And all I did through the whole thing was picture my face. That was so neat. I could have died right then. You see, your love had allowed me to accept me inside, first in my spirit, and then in my mind, and then slowly I could accept a lot of my feelings. And the last was I started accepting my face. I didn't try to do it for a year and a half to 2 years, because I was, that was enough. If I had, in a sense, died at that moment, it would have been okay. Because at that moment, it was okay to be a mouse, I guess. I could accept my heart as I was. But it became a lot greater. About 5 years later, I was at another conference in Irving, Texas, and my favorite AA speaker, I was talking to people about him today, Tom Iverson. I shouldn't use his last name, I'm sorry, but Tom. Tom, if you haven't had the privilege of listening to a talk of Tom, and if he has a talk of Tom, get it. And you need to know he's 40 years sober, and the man is much greater away from the podium than behind the podium. I'm shy, and I don't socialize. Tom is just magnetic, and he just oozes serenity. Jim and I had the honor of meeting him in Lubbock 2 years ago, almost right now. And there was such peace, such awe coming, such peace coming out of the man that it was like part of me wanted to pull away because it was more than I could handle, but all of me wanted to be there. I sure forgot why I was talking about Tom. But anyway, Tom was speaking in Irving, Texas. And it just, he was up here, and I was in the front row, and right in front of me, about 10 feet away, was a full-length mirror. And I had trouble listening to Tom because I was flirting with my looks. And I went from accepting me to that day liking me. And that's power in the program. Anyway, so I grew up feeling ugly. I grew up with parents who did the best they could, but it wasn't the best for me. And like the beat went on. They passed on the music they had heard. And my mother didn't want to be disturbed. And so I have a governor on my feelings. And most of the time I go through life feeling flat. Great things. I'm a Catholic priest. My alcoholism exploded with my ordination, and the worst days of my drinking were my first 3 years sober. I'm still a priest. I can have great things. Like ordained a priest, I didn't feel anything. I stood at my dad's grave when I was a senior at Penn State and felt a tinge of guilt because I didn't feel anything burying my dad. Occasionally I feel. Most of the time I don't. It's like a numbness. And other people feel. I remember being at an AA conference in Arkansas, and we were in a room about this size, but it was a restaurant, and almost everybody there was from the conference. It wasn't at the conference center. And there was one group in an area like this just having the true kind of fun AA did, and they were really living it up. And I snorted inside myself, and I looked at them, and I said, look at how childish they're acting. And thank God I had been in the program long enough to make the second sentence, and it was, yes, and don't I wish I had the freedom to be a child like that. Because, you see, I had to start becoming an adult taking care of my mom, I felt, at the age of 7. And I've never had the freedom to just be a child and just feel and be free. So I couldn't feel. And it's like, you know, inside me, the heart was wrong. I didn't have the right to look the way I did. I didn't have the right to feel the way I did. My mind was respected. I've heard fifth steps of people who are called stupid and dumb, and they don't respect their minds. And that's so hurtful to me. That wasn't as far as book knowledge, because neither of my parents had an education. My mother started working in a factory, quitting school at the age of fourth grade. My dad felt he died in the coal mines. He felt he had to work in the mines because it was the only thing he could do. So all of our life, the only thing we were, from kindergarten on, I had to graduate from college. And all three of us did. So book learning, they encouraged. And I've always been encouraged to think. But anything practical, I never was able to do anything practical to please either of my parents. If I did it, it wasn't right. And so I'm nearly paralyzed, nearly today, doing practical things. I'm bragging about it, and I got to stop talking about it, but I have an Acura right now with 237,000 miles on. I don't know where the dipstick is. I've never changed a tire on it. And I can laugh at my own defects now. One of my best friends lives fixing cars. And I was telling him before I got this one about a knock that I had in a car, and he says, you know how to fix that, don't you? I said, of course. You pick the phone up, you call the garage, they pick the car up, they bring it back, it's fixed. Isn't that the way everybody does it? You know, I can't do it. For me, changing a plate on an electrical outlet is a major thing, and I think I deserve a Nobel Prize when I've done it. Because my kid could never, ever do anything right. And if, you know, I grew up feeling that I didn't belong, that I had to be perfect or I'd be rejected, and if I were perfect, that wasn't good enough. Now, I believe that gave me the heart of a mouse. And so I went looking for magicians, and I tried everything. One magic I found, and I want to talk about this, because maybe there's someone here hurting badly enough, thinking that they're sick enough that nobody else here understands. I occasionally will joke about schizophrenia. And I try never to joke in the program about anything that might hurt a person. But you see, I believe I truly came to be absolutely borderline schizophrenic, and I'll tell you what it was. In my daydreams, I daydreamed my real world. And this world isn't perfect, because there's people in this world who don't like me. Okay? They don't appreciate me. And sometimes they cross the street to spit on me. And I don't even understand why. And most of the time, I don't win. I grew up absolutely abandoned by life. Nobody gave a damn about me growing up. I was emotionally abandoned. My mother was a workaholic. My dad was out of the house. I took my mother's love away from my older brother. He got my sister. I spent my childhood in a fantasy life under a porch. No friends in the neighborhood. Wasn't allowed to go out of the backyard. Went from my home into a Polish ghetto to go to school, and almost everybody else in my class, except for one other person, they all lived in that ghetto and they knew each other. And nobody disliked me, just nobody gave a damn about me. And in some ways, that's basically true through most of my life. People just don't know that Larry exists. It's like I'm not here. We had a tremendous Al-Anon speaker in Oklahoma, a gal named Ramona, who would talk about the loneliness of onlyness. And we were at this conference where they were acting up the childhood thing, and I spoke. And I told Ramona, I experienced something different that was even worse for me, and it's the loneliness of nothingness. And I saw Carol Burnett do a skit on this on her show, where waitresses, she's this kind of person, people don't notice them. You don't get Valentine cards. People just don't know you're there. That's one reason why it's so crucial for me never to use my title or my address in AA. You see, it would be deadly for me if anyone had time to deal with me because of a title, Father Larry. Because then I would think you were dealing with the office. And the amazing thing in the program is I have found sobriety, friends, sponsorship, and acceptance just as Larry. And so people in the program have noticed me, and I have a right to be here. But I grew up like so absolutely abandoned. So in my fantasy, I had my own real world with one big difference, and it was me. I'm 5'8". I'm Slavic in background, and I look like most of the people on the Politburo used to look. I tend to be small and chubby. And in America, I'm supposed to be 6'2", blonde, blue eyes, and thin, and athletic. And I'm none of those things. But I was in my fantasy. I was a perfect everything. In my fantasy life, everything about me, I was the perfect athlete, the perfect businessman, the great personality, great socializer, everything perfect. A year and a half, so whenever the world was painful, I'd retreat to fantasy. And at times, I think this magic was even more important than my drinking for giving me peace, because it was absolutely perfect. And a year and a half sober, I was in a daydream, and the phone rang. It took every ounce of willpower I had to leave the dream. And today, now if you've never been there, great. If you've been near here, you'll understand what I'm going to say. Today, I honestly don't know which is more rational. To stay in a world of dreams where I always win and never lose and there's no pain. Or to come into a real world where there's a lot of pain and I lose a lot. My regret would be if I ever went back into that fantasy world and stayed there, the real world wouldn't let me stay there. They do things to bring me back to the pain. So that would be a reason not to go back into there. But from that day on, I know I can't afford the luxury of daydreaming like that, because I would stay in the dream. I know why people, the Napoleons, I understand that. From that day on, this made sense to me, okay? So that's one of the magicians that I went to, but it didn't work. Because the real world, I would come back to. I wouldn't stay in my dreams. The real world impinged on me, and like the cat became had to face the dog had to face the tiger, and the threats were still out there. The second thing I tried, because it was the value in my family, was becoming something professionally, getting good grades. I have 11 years of college. This is not bragging, it's to tell you how things don't work. I'm Phi Beta Kappa, almost all straight A's. I've received great honors, and I don't remember getting any of them. Graduated from Penn State, and I am a rabid Penn State fan. Penn State was a great place for me. It taught me to think, and that was great for me in the church. Because I like to think. My God gave me a mind to use. But unfortunately, the real world was always there. And I believe my mind rejects unpleasant thoughts. The only times I remember of my years at Penn State were the days I was drunk. And I graduated at the age of 20. I didn't skip a grade. I started school very young. And so I never had a legal drink at Penn State, and it wasn't easy to get, but any time I could get it, I drank it. And when I had alcohol in my system, the magic worked, and the mouse became a tagger and sometimes even a hunter. And I felt okay, and I remember those times. I don't remember the honors I received. So the second magician I went to didn't work, and the third one I've been talking about, it was alcohol. Either at the age of 16 or 17, in an Italian bar, this is a very Slavic, they have trouble understanding this in Oklahoma because we don't have little ethnic pockets. But I grew up in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, and we had ethnic pockets all over the place, and it was an Italian bar on South Pine Street that I started drinking. I started drinking beer. And the magic happened. The mouse became a cat. The cat became a dog. The dog became a tagger. And the tagger was just vicious. I became great. Now, I didn't feel, I envy people who say they took a drink and they felt they were just like a Robert Redford. I didn't feel that. What I felt was there was a glow. I literally felt that my personality started glowing. And you would see the glow and you wouldn't see the ears. You wouldn't look at them. You would see the glow inside. So the ears were okay. And I became the life of the party, and my early drinking is wonderful. I hear people who never had any fun drinking, and I feel very sorry for them. I believe I'm not in an insane asylum today because I drank. Listen to this now. At the age of 16, I became sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I hadn't taken a drop or a pill yet. At the age of 14, I realized I would end my life permanently committed to a mental hospital. Right before I was a priest, I spent 6 weeks as an internship as a chaplain in a mental hospital. And I honestly believe that judgment was right, that I would have ended my life in a mental hospital if two things hadn't happened. Alcohol first, and then AA later. Alcohol kept me from going crazy. Because I had such fear, I had the heart of a mouse, and it looked like I was in a world of taggers. I was at a meeting yesterday, and I thought about this. You know, you heard the phrase, I would compare how I feel to how you look. And even right now, I'm relaxing a little bit, but you all look like you've got it together more than I do, okay? And what I compare is, I compare how I feel to how I think you feel given your what I'm looking at in you. That's what it is. It's not just with your looks. I project a feeling onto you because you have this trait, because you look like a cat in this respect. You can cat around. I have a lot of sexual hang-ups too that were passed on. So you're free to cat around, or, you know, or you're a dog, you know, you can pardon this, the grossness of this. You can piss on the world in ways that I can't. The taggers, you're free to hunt in ways that I can't, you know. I project feelings into you by taking a characteristic. You're tall, or you're athletic, or I feel you're attractive, or you seem to have grace. My hands have quivered my whole life. I've never been able to cut straight with scissors. I hated art from first grade on up, because I could never keep a crayon within the lines. And just felt, you know, there was always something wrong with me. And so you could do that, and I would fasten on the trait you had that I didn't. I would throw feelings on it, and I would take my, and I'd only make the comparison when I wasn't feeling good, and I would look at you, and, you know, all of a sudden you would look like something that I wasn't, and I'd be afraid. And I'm alone, and it's a different world. But when I drank, that wasn't like it. And alcohol worked for me, and it was a crutch through life. It allowed me to be social. People really accepted me. The only group I know I belong to, I know I belong to that group, before I came to AA, was the first group I drank with, a group of us kids in that bar on South Pine Street. Later, I would think I was with a group, but I wouldn't be too sure in the drinking. But alcohol would allow me to be with you. I could be nice. People liked me. I was a life of the party. I was a very, very different person. And it churned me. It was that magic. And then all of a sudden, one day, the magician stopped working. I've never controlled my drinking. I don't see any sense in controlling my drinking. I'll give you just little clues. You know, I blacked out all the time. I've done mass drunk. I would do an afternoon mass, and so I would come in at 5 o'clock in the morning and have to, or 6, and have to sneak by my pastor, who would be going over to church to do an early mass. There's lots of things. I have heard enough fifth steps that I'll beg you, please, never say all alcoholics. All alcoholics don't lie. Whatever you say all alcoholics do, I guarantee you I've heard a fifth step of an alcoholic who doesn't do it. Unless it's, you say all alcoholics drink alcohol. But it's not even commercial. I listened to a teacher in Oklahoma, a grammar school teacher who was an around-the-clock drunk and could never have booze on her breath. So she stayed drunk for 3 years on Listerine. And her problem was that she had a 50-mile radius of drugstores to get her supply. Because you can't walk into the same drugstore every week and clear them out of Listerine. They start, you know, especially in a small town. That's not easy to do. I used a different liquor store almost every day or every week because I couldn't buy all the stuff I was drinking. And, first, when I say all alcoholics, I never worried about my supply because I ordered the church wine. And we always had 52 gallon of wine. Now, the pastor determined the kind, and I didn't like it. But more than once, at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning, I had nothing to drink. I drank the last of my own. I'd get a key, walk half a block to the church, and come back with a gallon of wine and go right on drinking. I hid my empties. And I drank. It was basically a Canadian whiskey. And I would gather them all up, and I'd have, like, about every week or two, I'd have two big sacks of empty liquor bottles, and I would take them out. Now, honestly, I believed what I'm saying, and I didn't see anything wrong in this. I put them in the nun's dumpster. Because I didn't want the garbage collector to think we drank all that stuff. And I saw nothing wrong with that. Nothing at all. I mean, it was where I was at. I've never put a drink down. I've been sober a very long time. And I heard somebody talk about this. You know, if this were a drink of alcohol and you put it down and we're nursing it, I want to hit you. This is 26 years sober. I still want to slug you. Also, if it's there. Now, I was at a 12-step meeting. It's good after a period of time to have an event that hits me in the gut and says, you still got it. You know, early in the program, 1 year, I knew I was powerless. 5 years, I knew I was powerless. 10 years, the memory started getting hazy. 20 to 25, when I wake up in the morning, the first thing that hits me is not I'm powerless over alcohol, because it's been a while since I've been drinking. Things hit me that show me I'm not like earth people. That's what we call them in certain sections of AA in Oklahoma. I'm not like earth people. I was at a 12-step meeting chairing it in another fellowship, and a guy came in with a little girl, she's about 5 or 6, who had one of the worst coughs I've ever heard. And he went out and he got a bottle of cough medicine with codeine, and I knew there was alcohol in it. And he gave her two slugs and put it on the counter, on a table. And about 10 minutes later, I had to ask him to remove that bottle from sight. Because from the moment that bottle was on the table, I didn't hear another thing. And I guarantee you, if it were a big room like this and he carried that bottle around, I'd have known where it was every moment. Social drinkers don't do that, okay? It's just different for me. Alcohol was a magic. I blacked out. I had no control of it. I didn't want to control it. And then it turned. And when it turned, and this is what I was talking today, I am, When I count the things I'm grateful for in my life, this is one of the things I'm most grateful for. When it turned, I felt uglier, lonelier, dirtier drunk than I did sober. I felt ugly, dirty, and lonely sober, but I felt worse drunk, and I couldn't stop drinking. I could not stand me sober, and I hated me even worse drunk. And the clue, I mean, the best way to show it when it turned was I always drank in public. I met someone who was, I sobered up, I did 3 years as a priest in a town called Lawton, and that was the drinking, and I've done some of the houseplant smoking and other stuff like that, but it was basically alcohol is my drug of choice. And then I had 3 years sober in the same town, so I did get to make true living amends in this same parish. But I did most of my drinking in a place called the Purple Bunny Club. Okay. Now, I didn't want to give scandal. It's a town of, then it was about 70,000. I would put a green suit on and wear sunglasses so nobody would know who I was, okay? Now, I would take these people back from Vietnam in there to help them with their problems, and we would scream at each other over the music. And, of course, they paid for the drinks. Well, all of a sudden, I wasn't drinking with people in public. And that's the first living sign that stopped working. I was drinking in our parish house. There were three priests there, and I was drinking downstairs with them. Second stage, I was drinking upstairs alone in my bedroom, my suite. Third stage, I was drinking upstairs in my bedroom, doors closed, shades down, and hating the person who was in there, and it was me. And I cried out for help. And I looked for another magician. By that time, I had stopped believing in God. I hate telling people I'm a priest because, by the way, I tell people, I don't like priests. I wouldn't want my sister to marry one. And I mean that a variety of different ways. I mean, it's just true. And as soon as people in the program hear I'm a priest, they tune out because, you know, I'm going to come in with somebody else's God. Late in my drinking, I became an atheist. And it was the easiest way to drink as a priest. That's why I stayed in the priesthood. I had nothing to do but mass where I drank. And then I learned this very well. I would have a packet of manila folders and walk fast. And I'd go by somebody, and they'd say, Father, not now, I'll see you later, call for an appointment. And I'd zip in and up to my room because I couldn't see anybody. And I stayed in that room for about the last 9 months. And I cried out for help. The only thing I respected, I stopped believing in God. I was a total atheist. I stole every cent in the poor fund of that church. I didn't want there to be a God. The statute of limitations has rung, so I'm safe in saying that for anybody who's here. I still worshipped psychiatry, and I got a tremendous psychiatrist. And I saw him from December to May. And he had no magic. I drive to see him every Tuesday, wishing I had the strength to run my car into a culvert, praying, even though I didn't believe in God, that some drunk would cross over the turnpike and wipe me out. And I'm here today because I couldn't kill myself. And I'm here today because no human power could have relieved my alcoholism. He couldn't stop me from drinking, and he didn't have the power to change my heart. That's the important thing. To show what a great man this guy was, 4 weeks in AA, I had one of these Cloud Nine and an instant peace and an instant God experience. I didn't know it after 2 weeks, He looked at me. This is a quote, and I don't want to forget to say it. This man was so great. This is what he said. He took no credit. He said, Larry, 4 weeks in AA have given you what I hoped 2.5 more years of intensive therapy might give you. Every word of that is a direct. It just stayed with me so much, what the program offered to me. Anyway, he couldn't help, and there was just no hope. And finally, I got drunk at the home of somebody I knew was in AA, and I cried out for help. And I don't remember the rest of that night. And he told me that he and another person in the program that I knew also from the parish would be by the next day to see me. And that was a Sunday. And, of course, I had the morning after second thoughts.
Yeah.
I remembered us setting up the meeting, and then the rest was blacked out. And so the other guy came down the church steps, and I was about to tell him, I can't make it today, let's make it later in the week. And I think I'd be dead if I was able to say that. Before I could open my mouth, he said, we'll pick you up at 2 o'clock. And I've never had a drink or a mood change in chemicals since. Now, I stopped drinking. That didn't end any of the problems. I still had the heart of a mouse in a world of cats, dogs, tigers, and hunters. And that's what I needed the program for. And I have received the ability to change my heart. I'm going to tell you quickly the three stages in which this happened. The first is, you accepted me. And see, I came as an absolute failure. And you know it, you know. You know the love, you know the care, you know the concern. You accepted me. And I'm putting into words what I felt. It's like, we've shared so we care. But you weren't accepting me for anything I was or anything I did because I came to you as a total failure. And you accepted me. That's one of the great powers of the fellowship. I like to... I'm going to give two examples of this. I have a funny one that I dreamt up and then a serious one that I've seen. The funny one is, supposing I were the only person in the universe who I felt whoever had sex with a shark. And it was my deepest, most shameful secret. And for 12 years in the program, I've been carrying it. And finally, one day, I'm at a podium and the place is this big and I'm giving a talk and I just knew once I had sex with a shark. Somebody puts a hand up over here. Hammerhead off the Australia 2 years ago. Man and woman stand up here. Group sex. Great White. Florida last year. And nothing changes and everything changes. You see, my heart started changing because you gave me your heart first. I'm going to tell you the meetings that make that most sacred. I've been able to do this with people in other ways, but it wouldn't be as profound as this. I will tell you, without a doubt, the most sacred meetings I've been at have been about 10 meetings when a woman comes in crying, brand new to the program, and the courts have taken away her kids. And generally, the minute the table shut up, and I've listened to women go around, and half of them cry, and they talk about having children they didn't want and abusing them, as parents, giving kids up for adoption, having kids taken away by the court and wondering about them, having kids taken away by the court, aborting. They just go around the table and they share. And it's nothing changes and everything changes. And somehow the giving of a heart is so sacred that I feel touched by God at those meetings. I know that God is present in all of his sacredness. It's like, you know, it's the great word said, neither do I condemn you. I don't condemn you. And it goes across. And you didn't condemn me. You accepted me. And you gave me your heart. But after a while, I had to change my heart. And that's so the first, it starts with fellowship. And then it goes to the recovery. And there's so much here. The first three steps, I had to realize that I'm powerless. There's nothing I can do to change my own heart. And there's nothing I could do to touch alcohol. I'm powerless, my life's unmanageable, and I can't keep alcohol out of my life. And I marvel at most people. I don't think any of you came to the program the way I did. I have had the honor of listening to a lot of Fifth Steps. And I think one or two people only in all my experience were as emotionally screwed up as I am. And I share that not to brag, but so that my pain can give you hope, because I found tremendous peace. I found a God. I found myself and I found others through the program. I don't want to forget to say that, because I don't think we heal by sharing our accomplishments. We heal by sharing our pain. I grew up suicidal. I've been seriously suicidal at least at one time or another 20 of my 25 sober years. And I've come to see that it's proof the program's working. Because you see, suicide is a form of escape. An AA speaker from California said she just wanted to commit suicide for a little while.
Yeah.
And that put it all in perspective. That's all it is. You know, if I could just learn that art. It would just be perfect. And what happens is there's some problem, and my, you know, I've got the heart of a mouse in the looking at a tiger, and I want to escape. And I run to the door, alcohol, and it's closed. Run to the door, drugs, it's closed. Run to the door, compulsive eating, it's closed. And I can go all around my other, all these other doors are closed. And the mind is still frantic. That little mouse is frantic. How can I face the world? And suicide's a symbolic form of escape. And in my case today, when I get these thoughts, they're unpleasant and I'm in a bad place, but it's proof my program's working. And all I got to do is walk through it. And be honest about it. Because if I look at people and say I'm fine, I feel worse. If I share with my sponsor, and if I share at a meeting, if it's relevant, then all of a sudden, somehow, people still accept me, and my heart starts growing larger, and I start getting the ability to walk through this, and eventually walk out of it. So I have been very, very screwed up in this program, but the program has given me much peace. I came with instructions to arrive after the meeting started and leave before it ended. And I did that at least my first 2 weeks. It's the only way I could have come to AA. There is such happiness and peace in your eyes, and I read eyes. Happy eyes, to me, are among, they have to be among the great seven wonders of the world. God is just bouncing in a person's life when I see them. They just excite me so much. And I was 10, 15 years sober before someone, I was speaking somewhere, and someone told me, you know, you have a twinkle in your eye. And I know at times I do now. I wasn't aware it was there. But it's the twinkle in your eyes that helps me appreciate first this program. And I saw that. I could not have come down and sat next to you in my first meeting 5 minutes early and stayed. I just could not look at joy and happiness like that and stayed in the room. Because it was too churned up in here. So I came, and they also told me to say nothing. Came late, left early, and felt peace. In 2 weeks in the program, the first miracle occurred. I woke up one morning, and I was okay at the deepest level of my being. First time I'm aware in my life of knowing it's okay to be Larry. It's okay to have the heart of a mouse. It's okay. I still had to work the program. But on the deepest level, and I didn't call this God. I didn't analyze it. I just enjoyed it. And the greatest thing is I've never tried to put my God into a box. I've had some honors of doing retreats and things. And one of them, I just had this thought bounce into my mind, and I had everybody write down the word that would best describe their experience of God. And we went around, and some gal surprised me, because her word was, her God was surprising. And do you know, that's my second word for God now? He's my best friend, and he's absolutely surprising. Young gal in the program in Colorado Springs says, you know how to make God laugh? Start making plans for your future. That's one of the most profound things I've heard in the program, and it's just absolutely deep. Anyway, I had a piece. And I just let it happen. And I could not do 1, 2, 3. I did 1, 3, 2. I came. I did what I was told, which was a living surrender. I turned my life and my will over to the care of people who had something I didn't have, who had a sparkle. And then it started working for me. And I just couldn't believe it was working. It was just so fabulous and so wonderful. Now, if I'm going to have peace, I have to know who I am. I have to know precisely who I am and what my size is. And that's the fourth step. I had to know I was a mouse. I'm not a cat. I'm not a tiger. I'm not a dog. I got to live as Larry. You know, I've got to stop looking at you and trying to become the traits you have. I got to see who I am and find peace with who I am. My five great events in my life. One occurred about 10 years sober. I went through midlife crisis. And at that point, I felt I'd wasted my whole life, and I was useless. And I'm thrilled I went through that. And I hate to tell you this because I don't want to give you the answers before you walk through it. But the 11 and 12 steps are the answers that I found from that. And it's a whole different thing. You see, I'm sober today, and that's a miracle from God. And if God has me sober today, there's at least one person first. If God's in love with me, I'm not a failure. And if I have different values, one of us is wrong, me or God, okay? So that's the first thing. Meditation, the 11th step, helps me know I'm not a failure. And the 12th step tells me I'm not useless. I honestly believe that if I'm alive today, there's someone out there who needs me to carry the message of what God has done to me to them. The world may not recognize me or notice me or want me, but there's someone out there who needs me. And I will tell you, if I have the ability to touch someone's heart, and take away someone's pain the way others have touched my heart and taken away my pain, I've got a purpose to live. So I've reason to continue to breathe, and that's the 12th step. There at the end to this feeling of uselessness. Anyway, I had to inventory myself. I had to see that I was just a mouse. And it's okay. It was just okay to be Larry. And I wrote out exactly what I was. But you see, that didn't give me the freedom to be, because I was a mouse. Another way I like to put it is, I was a dandelion in a world that claimed that dandelions were a weed, and God wanted me in his garden, and the world didn't. And if I was going to hide what I was, I couldn't have peace. If I was going to try to tell you and try to pretend I'm a tulip or a rose or a carnation, I can't do those things. I can't become those things. The only way I can ever have peace is when I recognize who I am and properly become me. And the freedom to do that came from the fifth step. It's the first time I took all of this. I've got the heart of a mouse and gave it to another person. And he just sat there. A good example of this came later, 12 years sober. I've had the same sponsor for 25 years now. I called my sponsor and I had really screwed up and hurt someone badly. And I called him and told him what I did. And I said, I feel very guilty about this. And his response was sacred. He said, you deserve to. But what he said, see, so often we think we have to validate everybody's actions. He was mature enough to know what I did was wrong, but his tone said, what you did was wrong, but you're still okay. And it's like this, neither do I condemn you, but don't do this again. You hurt someone else, don't do that. You hurt yourself, don't do that. But you're still okay. And that's what the fifth step gave me. Despite all of this, I'm still okay and I have a right to be. And that's why the big book says I'm building an arch to freedom. And this is the step where I start really first experiencing my God. You see, only when I had the right to be Larry did I give God the right to be God. If I had to be a rose, then God was someone who demanded everybody be roses and I wasn't one. And there's something wrong with God. And the day I gave myself the right to be a dandelion was the day I gave my God to be the freedom to be the God who made me. I accept me, so I'll accept the God who made me now. And that makes my God much more real, human, and lovable. So I started getting the ability to change my own heart. The sixth and seventh steps were very, very, very powerful. But I want to rush on. The eighth and ninth, clearing away some of the wreckage, gave me more freedom. But the ability to change my heart came out of the 11th step. I have a lot of things I want to do here, but this is my present to you. Jim came down for my 25th AA birthday, and he put a lot of thought in the gift that he gave me. And I appreciate that, because I think Jim was, I knew him during his drinking, absolutely self-centered. He was a selfish SOB. But so was I. And back then, he would have thought what he could get from me rather than what he could give to me. And because his gift showed so much thought and so much sacredness, I thought, what can I give him for his 20th? And it really, really started confusing me, and I finally thought of what I wanted to do. And this is not new. This really is my most sacred object, my most treasured object that I've got, so it's used. And I'd like you to unveil it and pass it around. As people are looking, I'm going to explain this. Basically, I get the ability to become me by letting God love me. God, some people see as truth, and that means I think about God. I see, let me show it because people will be straining till they do as soon as you get it. Then they can pass around and see it. I'm going to get to this in a moment. It's a statue done by a professor in Texas. I hope you've never seen it. It's Jesus washing the feet of Peter. And it's the most, there's nothing romantic about it at all. As you see it, notice how big Peter's feet are. Okay, that's in particular. From the moment I first saw that, I have been in love with that statue. And I'll tell you why. I had been talking about, is there a scene in the Bible that best captures your experience of God? Because we're all different, and God is going to want each of us to touch Him differently. And people do have different scenes, and whatever that scene is, if there's something that rings your bell, stay with that scene and use it as your doorway always to know God. Well, before I said this spontaneously in a sermon, for about 6 months I had been coming back again and again and again to Jesus washing Peter's feet. And after I said it, it all made sense, because you see, watch this now. If you don't believe in the Bible, don't worry, because I'm not taking it as inspired. I'm taking it as a parable that reflected my reality of God in the program. I had a great member of our church tell me I found God in AA, and this is where I must always find Him first. I find Him here and thank Him there. Because this is the doorway He gave me to find Him. And that image is the image that worked, because you see, I came feeling I was absolutely, totally dirty and soiled by life. And what did you do? In this scene, He takes off all of His clothes. He humiliates Himself, puts a towel around Himself, and He does the most menial task. He washes feet because they're dirty. What did you do? I came feeling dirty. I came late. I was told to shut up. And you told me how you failed. You stripped yourself of your dignity. You stripped yourself naked, and you washed me clean. You did the things I did. And by telling me about this, somehow I felt okay. This reality is so deep for me that after I had the insight I'm sharing with you, it's still my basic doorway to God. About 2 years later, I was in a chapel for a while trying to meditate, and everything was flat. I went into that chapel and tried to honor God. And it was just like there was a wall there. And it took me 2 weeks to realize I had a God up here that I was trying to honor. That's not the God I've got. I don't have a God up here who wants me to honor Him. I've got a God down on His feet that simply asks for the privilege of honoring me. You may have been in need at somebody when this was said at Tyler House. It capsules AA so beautifully. We don't want anything from you. We want something for you. We want the privilege to wash you clean. That's what I experienced. You continue to give yourself to me to wash me clean. And so see, if I'm hurting and I come with pain and I say I'm fine, I'm not letting you wash me clean. If I come and I'm hurting and I tell you some of the things that are upsetting me, and you look at me with love, and you tell me you know people who walk through the same thing, or you tell me you walk through the same thing, you tell me you've had the pain, somehow I know I'm still okay. And it's just great. Meditation changes my heart. It's the way I experience God. And meditation is something I experience in the program. Remember, I found God in AA. I said, these are some of the things we're sharing today, where I can go to a group, and if I'm hurting and I come in, if I'm afraid and I come in here and I stay with you, and I'm at a meeting and I get called and I say, you know, I'm really worried about, I had a scene with my bishop, a conference with him, and they've all been tragic up until now. I've always been creamed every time the bishop calls me, because I'm a weirdo. I mean, all right, I don't fit the mold too well. And I got a call on Thursday that he wanted to see me as soon as I could get down to the city, and I just went through every possible crisis. And it was all great. Everything was loving, and he talked about his concern for what's happening to my mind. I gave him some instances where I'd forgotten things, unbelievable, wiped out whole occasions recently, services I did. And he was very concerned and spoke with real love and then paid me some compliments. But that's not the big thing. The big thing was when I, at the meeting and with people in the program, I had to share my pain, share my hurt, and then feel the love. And see, when I'm with you and I tell you I'm afraid, you know what happens? I feel a little bit less afraid. When I part from you, when I apart from your acceptance and go back out to a car, all of a sudden I'm afraid again. When I stay with the God loving me, my God wants to give Himself to me to wash me clean, to give me a new heart
And that's how my heart starts changing. My God gives me his heart through you. And you wash me clean. And you let me know it's okay to be Larry. You know, there's a glow. I hadn't thought about it. In my drinking, I thought people saw the glow. Well, dandelions have a glow. It's a color between a yellow and a gohoot. And I'm a dandelion. And there's a glow to me. And often you people have seen it. Now, the last part of changing my heart is service, the triangle. And I hadn't thought of sharing it this way, but it just works so beautifully. You see, when I feel I have the heart of a mouse is when I'm looking at what you can do to me. But if I look at what I can do to you, what I have to give you, then I can have God's heart inside me, and I can share that with you. And the answer to my disease and the last answer to my pain when I do this is carrying the message. I'm still exceptionally uncomfortable socially. When I got to do things as a priest socially, I go, I'm seen so the people aren't embarrassed, and then I run. But let somebody come into my office with a pain, and I'm willing to listen because I know pain, and I'll share. I don't listen and give them a lecture. I listen about how I know pain. If you've been in depression, when I say I was depressed, if any of you know depression, it's like being in a fog that puts 40 pounds of pressure on every square inch of your being. And you know what you're supposed to do, and you just don't have the strength to move in that fog. Yes, I should go up and do all these things tomorrow. It's just too heavy today. And if I share that with people, I see they understand. If I go in and talk about my difficulties in any area, they understand that I understand, and there's a healing goes on there. And I come back and I feel so good. I feel like I've had a purpose to live. And that life is all worthwhile. That statue summarizes everything that I think this program is. It summarizes how I could come to you with the heart of a mouse. And I have to come to you. I can't have it changed otherwise. I still make, so you know this, and I'm nearly done, I'm committed to 4 meetings a week. That's what I made early in my sobriety. I make 2 meetings on Monday at noon in Enid and at 7 o'clock in Oklahoma City. I make a meeting on Tuesday, and I make a meeting on Thursday. 4 meetings. I sponsor, and I'll pass this on just in case you can do it. If you're dealing with someone who's struggling and they can't stay sober, I have found great success in having them call me the moment they get up. The only thing they're allowed to do before they call me is go to the bathroom if their bladder's ready to blow up. And then I tell them, if you make that call, you're telling yourself you're putting sobriety first in your day-to-day. Mm-hmm. I've been doing this for 5 to 6 to 7 years. Only one person making it has ever drunk the day they've done it. If they tell me they're also still struggling, we then say the third step prayer together. And if they've gone on and they've passed the 7th step, and I have people struggling do that, we do the 3rd and the 7th step prayer together. So I get about 7 calls early in the morning, and when I want to sleep in, it really gets me. But thank God I can fall asleep quickly after they do it, and it allows me to keep my sobriety. But I have a purpose in living. You know, have I wasted my sobriety? If you died today and you came before you as God to pass judgment on your life, how would you judge you? 27 years ago, I'd have failed me. At times in the last 27 years, I'd have failed me. Today, I wouldn't. Because I know that in a human way, as a mouse, I've taken the love that I've been given, I've allowed it to flow into my heart, and I hope through that to you. Congratulations, Jim, and thank you very much.
Real quickly, I just want to thank everybody who helped put this together. Thank you. And we have a nice way of closing. Close with a moment of silence for those in and out of these rooms who are still suffering, followed by the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Keep coming back. It works if you work it.